16. Jane, Jane, Janie, Mrs. Schneider muttered to herself as she stared out the window. Jane, Jane, Janie. She'd forgotten all about Janie, but now she remembered. Ever since that nosy reporter came poking his nosy nose around, the Mexicans across the street were all home today, except for the police officer. The two women were out front, weeding the flower beds together and laughing. The other man was watering the front lawn with the hose. As Mrs. Schneider watched, she saw him turn and spray the women briefly with the hose and laugh. His teeth were very white against his brown face, and she thought he looked handsome for a moment. Like that Ricky Ricardo that Lucy married, she said. Except he wasn't Mexican, she recalled. He was Cuban. Not that it matters, she said. They all look the same, and they all jabber at each other in Spanish. What's the difference? Her fingers kept rubbing against each other, like she was washing her hands without any water or soap. She couldn't seem to stop doing it. Janie, she said again. And it wasn't only Janie that she remembered. She remembered other girls, too. Girls that Janie went to school with, or who were a little younger. Girls that ended up in the woods with their bodies all ripped to pieces, nothing left but their heads. It was like something had peeled away in her brain, a tightly wrapped bandage that was coming undone. And underneath the bandage was something red and black and pulsing. A wound that had never healed but separated. But now that it was open again, she didn't know what to do. Those Mexicans couldn't have killed Janie or the other girls. It had to be somebody else. But those girls were always killed in November, she said. Remember, remember, November. No, that's not how the rhyme goes. It's remember, remember, the 5th of November. And it's nothing to do with America. It's all about some plot in England. But all those girls were killed in November, and my Janie too. These girls were killed in June, though. And that's wrong. They're not at the right time. They're not even from Smith's Hollow either. They're outsiders, just like those Mexicans. That's why it happened, because those Mexicans came in, and they were outsiders, and so outsiders were killed at the wrong time. And that means it is their fault after all. Her hands stopped chafing one another as she realized this. A strong sense of relief washed over her. All was in order again. She'd been right in the first place. But what to do about it? She didn't think Chief Christie would be any help. He'd hired one of them after all. And his father had never seemed to care much about Janie. Poor little Janie. Dead little Janie. Janie wasn't the only dead girl, though. There had been other girls, other parents who wept. Mrs. Schneider wondered if they remembered now, too. If they did, then perhaps they could do something about these outsiders that had upset the apple cart. But do you really want to go back to the way it was before? She asked herself. One girl every year. Yes. That was the way of things here. It was sad, but once the outsiders were removed, then everything would return to normal. And she would forget about Janie again, forget about the years of happiness and the pain that followed. She would forget, as she should. Mrs. Schneider went into the kitchen and took out her address book. She thought she knew who might be able to help her. 17. Alex wiped sweat off his forehead with his handkerchief. The fair was on an open field and the sun beat straight down onto the grounds. There was hardly any relief to be found. The one place with guaranteed shade was the performance tent. Alex supposed he could justify spending some time in there. since many of the attendees were no doubt having their pockets picked while they watched the circus-like spectacle. The presence of police officers might deter that behavior, even if it was just for 15 minutes or so. He and Miller had separated so that they could cover more ground. But Alex was pretty certain that Miller had found a bench near a fried food booth and was patrolling from there. Alex glanced at his watch. His shift had begun at 2 and would run until the fair closed at 10. It was only 3:30, which meant many more hours of walking in the heat. Many of the townspeople who saw him as he walked along waved and called his name. But Alex saw a good number of people he didn't recognize. The fair was a big success then. It had done what Tui wanted and drawn out-of-towners to Smith's Hollow. The previous night, Alex had seen the evidence of this, as he'd hauled several drunk and disorderly types into the 2 cells that they had at the station. Almost all of them were not Smith's Hollow natives. And Alex was counting down the days until the fair ended, and everything went back to being quiet and normal. Or as quiet and normal as it could be with one girl being murdered every year. The day before, he'd had some time in the evening to continue his search of the archives. What he'd found had made his blood run cold, even as it bewildered him. There had been one death every year in the woods going all the way back to the beginning of paper records, 1937. And Alex felt sure that the deaths went back even further, even if there was no written evidence of it. That meant 50-plus years of dead girls, always taken on the same day, always found in the same place. Yet, no one mentioned it. No one seemed to think anything was wrong. There had to be generations of grieving families in Smith's Hollow, but it was never, ever discussed. There's something very wrong in this town, he thought, and he didn't even know how to begin to get to the bottom of it. At first, he had an idea that it was somehow related to Van Christie and the mayor, but the line of deaths going back so far put them out of the picture. The history of the murders went back before they were born. He had a vague thought that it could be some very old serial killer, one who'd started young and would be ancient now. But that didn't explain why Christie was so intent on pretending the murders never happened. Could this person be a relative of his? Christie's father had been the chief of police before him. Maybe 2 generations of cover-ups had all been in service of keeping some cousin or uncle or brother out of jail. Alex shook his head. It didn't make sense. No matter how many ways he tried to fit the jigsaw puzzle together, he never got the full picture. Maybe it's Christie himself? That thought gave him pause. And what? His father was a killer before him and his father before him? It would explain why every chief of police, and they were all named Christie, every single one, had so determinedly ignored the murders. But it seemed crazier than any other theory he'd come up with yet. The idea of an annual murder being passed down like some kind of demented family legacy. He detoured to a food booth, where burgers were being charred on a grill and ordered a cold Coke with extra ice. A man with a large black mustache and heavy Greek accent waved away Alex's dollar bill.
"Thanks for being out here, officer," he said.
"No problem," Alex said.
"Thank you."
He popped the top off the cup and pulled out the straw, drinking half the contents in one gulp. He continued patrolling, even though he really wanted to sit for a few moments. He felt that he shouldn't sit down, unless he was on a meal break. When he finished the pop, he fished out the few unmelted ice cubes and chewed on them. Alex saw Lauren DiMucci and her little brother standing in line to play at the half-size miniature golf course. He wanted to talk to Lauren about her discovery of the backpacks in the woods, but he didn't think it was appropriate to talk about it in front of her 4-year-old brother, so he decided to leave it until later. The heat, the smell of cooking grease, and the constant chorus of screams were making Alex feel a little sick to his stomach. He decided to sip for a few minutes, even if it wasn't an official break time. He found the nearby bench and closed his eyes, breathing deeply in and out through his nose. It wasn't just the atmosphere of the fair that was bothering him. It was a sense that the town had taken an indrawn breath, waiting for a blow to fall. But that's idiotic, he thought, opening his eyes and looking at all of the people smiling and laughing and stuffing popcorn in their mouths. None of them seemed like they were braced for impact. His eyes roamed around. As he looked, it was like an ugly seam opened up under the cheerful exterior. There was a stressed-looking mother dragging her teenage daughter by the wrist away from a smirking long-haired boy. There were twin boys fighting over who got to hold the stuffed monkey their father had just won at the shooting gallery. There was a 20-something man wearing a gray army t-shirt, arguing with a bottled blonde in the tiniest denim shorts Alex had ever seen this side of Daisy Duke. Something about the man's face and body language had Alex up and running toward the couple. He was still a few feet away when the man swung a roundhouse fist toward the blonde's pink glossed mouth. She stumbled backward, clutching her jaw. Son of a bitch! And there's more if you keep talking back to me like that, you dumb little cunt, he shouted. Several people stopped walking to stare at the altercation. They immediately created roadblocks for Alex, who was already pulling his cuffs off his belt. Excuse me, police, he shouted, pushing his way through the crowd. A young mother holding the hand of a fat-faced toddler shouted at him as he shouldered past her. Hey, watch it, you fucking spick! It had been a long time since anyone had called Alex a spick while he was wearing his uniform. He'd heard it plenty in Chicago when he was out of uniform. And of course, Mrs. Schneider regularly insulted his entire family, but somehow he hadn't expected it in Smith's Hollow. He thought about stopping and telling her to watch her language. She'd popped off the F-word without any concern for who might be listening. But the blonde had just been assaulted, and his duty was to the victim, not his own feelings. Before he could clear the crowd, however, a second man, wearing a navy blue Hawaiian shirt, shot out of the group of onlookers and tackled the man wearing the army shirt. Hawaiian shirt held army shirt down with his left hand and delivered several punches to army shirt's face with his right. Damn it, Alex swore, taking two quick steps and dragging Hawaiian shirt off the first man. Hawaiian shirt automatically backfisted Alex's nose. It didn't crunch, but it made Alex see stars for a second. Police! He shouted in Hawaiian shirt's ear. You will cease and desist that shit immediately. Hawaiian shirt immediately went limp in Alex's grip. Sorry, officer. I didn't realize. Army shirt was lying on the ground, not moving. And the bottled blonde he punched crawled over to him and began to wail. Vinny! Vinny, speak to me! She screamed, shaking his immobile form. What a fucking pain in the ass, Alex thought. Where the hell was Miller? How was he supposed to deal with the injured man, his hysterical girlfriend, and this third party all on his own? If I let go of you, will you stand still and not make any more trouble? Alex said to Hawaiian Shirt. The man nodded. Yes. What's your name? Larry Franco. You live in Smith's Hollow, Larry Franco? Yeah, he said. Alex let the man go, confident that if he ran off, Alex would be able to find him again. What are you doing arresting him? Someone shouted from the crowd. He was just trying to help that girl. Several people murmured in agreement. Yeah, don't harass that guy. What's wrong with you? Alex ignored them. He needed to get the girl off the guy, check his medical condition, and call the EMTs. The girl's jaw was swelling, too. She'd need an ice pack at the very least. Ma'am, I'm going to need you to move away from the victim, Alex said. He clicked on his radio. Miller? No response. Miller, he said again, trying not to let his frustration creep into his tone. He felt like he was performing on a stage with all the people watching him, but he didn't have time to shoo them away and deal with the couple at the same time. He had used his cop voice on the woman, the one that expected cooperation, but he should have expected the woman wouldn't cooperate. After all, She was on the ground hugging the man who'd punched her in the face.
"You arrest that asshole," she screeched, pointing at Larry Franco. "Look what he did to Vinny's face."
"He was just trying to help you, you dumb bitch," someone shouted.
The crowd was growing larger by the second, and Alex felt a current of ugliness running underneath.
"Fuck off," she shouted at the crowd.
"Ma'am, I need to check your friend's medical condition," Alex said, ignoring the interaction. Army Shirt's face was far too pale. Alex was going to have to pull the girl off him. She had thrown her body over his torso, making it impossible to so much as check the man's pulse.
"Just drag her off by her hair," someone said.
"That's police brutality,"
someone else said and laughed.
Oh yeah, there's something wrong here.
And it was getting more wrong by the second.
"Miller," he shouted into the radio.
Finally, there was a lazy half asleep.
"What?"
"Christ, he fell asleep somewhere."
"Get your ass up and over by the zipper ride, and call the EMTs while you're at it. We've got two assault victims here."
"Okay, boss," Miller said.
Alex hoped like hell that Miller was awake enough to follow his instructions. There was nothing for it. He was going to have to pull the crying woman off Vinny. He bent over and touched her shoulder, hoping that would be enough to prompt her. It was, but not in the way he expected. She jerked backward, spinning around in the dirt and screaming in his face.
"Don't fucking touch me, you fucking dirty spick!"
"That's it. I have had enough."
He wrapped his hand around her upper arm and pulled her away from Vinny. She screamed like his fingers were emitting acid.
"Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Don't you dare touch me!"
A ripple of energy seemed to roll over the crowd, something mean and dangerous.
"Hey, get your hands off her," an onlooker said.
"It's not right for him to touch a white woman like that," another said.
What is going on? Is there a meeting of the local chapter of racist assholes at the fair today? He felt a sudden, very strong urge to take his gun out of its holster and demonstrate to the shitty crowd of shitty racists just who was in charge. His fingers were on the grip before he even knew what he was doing. Alex never drew his gun unless he felt he absolutely had to do it. He knew too many officers in Chicago who shot first and asked questions later, and he'd always sworn to himself that he wouldn't be one of them. He didn't know what was happening now, why he was taking his gun out and pointing it in the direction of the crowd that seemed to be swelling like a wound, the crowd that seemed strangely nonplussed by the presence of the gun. They moved toward him in a kind of slow motion creep, like the inexorable movement of the tide.
"Back away," he shouted.
But they didn't back away. They pushed toward him. Their eyes fixed only on him. The bottled blonde pointed her finger at him.
"You're an outsider," she intoned. "You don't belong here."
The term was repeated over and over by every voice. It rolled through like dominoes falling.
"Outsider. Outsider, outsider."
Alex couldn't see over the crowd. Anyone who came within its orbit seemed to be pulled into its gravity. And nobody was protesting. Nobody was going to help him.
"Whatever is happening is only happening right here," he thought, as his sweaty hand struggled to keep the gun from slipping to the ground.
He could hear the sounds of the rides running, bells ringing from the game booths, shouts and screams and laughter. The zipper was only a few feet away, but it continued to load and run normally. Nobody seemed to notice that there was something wrong here. Alex didn't know what would happen when the crowd reached him, but he had a horrible sense that they would rend and tear, that there would be nothing left of him but his head.
Just like those girls in the woods.
Was this what happened to them? Were they set upon by a mad crowd of people who forgot what they'd done afterward?
Now is not the time to try to solve the mystery, Alejandro. They're going to eat you in a minute.
Yes, that was what would happen. They would tear him and eat him, just like that black and white movie with the living dead. He'd seen it on the Svengoolie show once, and Sophia had buried her head in his shoulder whenever the screen showed the living dead people eating body parts. And in that movie, the only way to defeat the living dead was to shoot them in the head. Could he do that? Could he shoot people he thought were his friends and neighbors? Could he kill someone who didn't appear to be in his right mind? Why not? I bet some of them are in their right mind. Some of them probably think I'm a dirty wetback, think my kind shouldn't mix with their kind. They're just too polite to say it where I can hear. In that way, he supposed, Mrs. Schneider was at least honest. You knew where you stood with her. His finger flexed on the trigger. Directly in front of him was Sam Carpenter, a teenager who worked at the sweet shop. He also played football for the high school, and his hands were the size of dinner plates. Those hands were curled now into gigantic fists. Fists that would pound Alex into ground beef in a minute. But he also snuck bubblegum to Val whenever the Lopez family went into the shop to buy ice cream, because, he said, you might need it for your experiments. And Camila and Danielle never left without their pockets loaded with lollipops. How could that boy, that sweet-natured boy who bought Alex's kids lollipops with his own money, be standing in front of Alex with murder in his eyes? And how could Alex live with himself if he shot that boy?
Hey, what's going on here?
It was not as Alex had hoped and expected, Miller's voice. It was a girl's voice, high and angry. A ripple went through the crowd again, and all of them turned, their heads moving in eerie synchronicity.
Get out of the way, the girl said.
Alex felt a strange reverberation in his chest when she shouted, a sense that if she spoke, he would have to listen. The crowd parted. Alex saw, as if at the end of a long tunnel, Lauren DiMucci standing there with her brother David. For a moment he thought, too, that he saw something else, something like electricity arcing away from the two of them. Lauren hurried toward him, her face twisted up. David appeared very calm.
Are you all right?
She said breathlessly. Alex realized he still had the gun raised, though Lauren didn't appear to notice it at all. He hurriedly put it in his holster. Yes, he said, then pointed at Vinny lying very still on the ground behind him. But he's not.
Don't worry, we saw Officer Miller and he's waiting for the EMTs at the front of the fair.
Lauren said this all in a rush, like she was embarrassed that she had this information. Then she turned to the crowd, who were now standing like idling cars, their engines ready to rev again at a moment's notice.
Get out of here, Lauren said. Go back to what you were doing before.
Alex watched in amazement as the crowd dissolved. None of them appeared to realize what they'd been doing before Lauren told them to leave. The bottled blonde ran to Vinny's side again, her floods of tears washing over his face. Alex heard very faintly the sweet music of the ambulance siren.
Thank Christ, he thought.
Larry Franco stood off to the side, exactly where Alex had left him before everyone else went crazy. David tugged on Lauren's shorts.
Can we have cotton candy now? We haven't had cotton candy yet.
Sure, bud, Lauren said. She took his hand and they started to move away.
Wait, Alex shouted.
They both turned back, identical quizzical expressions on their faces.
How did you know I was in trouble?
He asked. This seemed the least of the things he wanted to know. He wanted to know why the crowd acted that way, and why Lauren had been immune to it, and why they had all listened when she told them to leave.
Oh, David knew, Lauren said,
and David grinned at him.
David knew? How did David know? The same way you knew where the girls' packs were in the woods? What else do the two of you know?
Wait, I want to...
Alex started. But just then, Miller and the two EMTs came running up. Alex directed the EMTs toward the man on the ground, quickly explaining the circumstances. They got to work on the man while Alex directed Miller to call Hendricks and Pantaleo to pick up Larry Franco. They would have to process him at the station, so that there would be a record in the event Vinny pressed charges. By the time all of this was finished, the DiMucci siblings were long gone, of course. He'd expected they would be. Lauren had a guilty look on her face, like she'd done something wrong when she ordered the crowd away from him. "But I wanted to say thank you," Alex murmured. The only reason he could go home and hug his children that night was because of those two strange kids. He wanted to thank them, and he wanted to know a few other things, too. He looked at his watch and sighed. Whatever he wanted to know was going to have to wait until his shift was over. A few minutes later, Miller jogged up, or at least what passed for jogging with Miller, who never seemed to exert very much energy.
"All taken care of," he said. "I'm starving."
Alex laughed. He couldn't help it. It was so normal to hear Miller say he was hungry.
"Let's get French fries," Alex said, and Miller grinned.
18. Miranda stood on her front porch at 7 p.m., tapping her foot impatiently as she waited for Tad to pull up. She didn't want Tad to come to the door. There was the smallest possibility that Janice might decide to stumble into the hallway and pretend to be a mother. Miranda thought she would die of shame if Tad saw Janice in her bathrobe. The sun still shone, though it wasn't as hot as it had been earlier in the day. It wouldn't get dark for another hour or so, which meant Tad had plenty of time to admire how pretty she was in the slanting sunlight. She heard the roar of the Camaro a minute before she saw it pull down her street. Miranda hastily applied her lip gloss and smoothed down her yellow dress. She thought she looked exceptionally good, and that was saying something. Her hair was curled and sprayed into place, so it would stay put if they went on the tilt-a-whirl or the Ferris wheel. The sundress had string ties to hold it up at the shoulders, and that meant that she couldn't wear a bra underneath without showing the straps. She was sure that Tad would notice. It had been a job getting out without her father seeing her, though. He certainly would have noticed and sent her back upstairs to put something else on. The dress wasn't that short when she was standing, but she knew that when she sat down, it would roll back to just above her knee. She had on white leather sandals that showed off pink polished toenails. Tad might not appreciate those as much as her lack of bra, but at least she knew she'd put in the correct amount of effort. Her white leather purse even matched her shoes. She ran down the path toward the car as it pulled up. Tad didn't get out to open the door for her, which irritated her. And then she got even more annoyed when the passenger side door opened and Billy climbed out, grinning. He pushed the front seat out of the way so he could climb in the back. "What is Billy doing here? I thought this was a date." She wouldn't have put in half the amount of effort she had if she had known the third wheel was going to tag along.
"Hey, babe," Tad said, leering at her legs when she climbed in the front seat.
"Hello," she said primly, arranging her skirt so that it would be as modest as possible. He wasn't getting so much as a glimpse of her underwear tonight. What kind of jerk asked a girl out and then brought his friend along?
"Well, what did you expect? Tad is a child."
"Not like him." She felt a warm flush of pleasure at the thought of him. Maybe she would see him at the fair. Maybe she could sneak away with him in the dark. Tad immediately turned up the car radio, blasting Iron Maiden. Miranda hated heavy metal. Def Leppard was one thing. They weren't super heavy, but Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath, that kind of thing, was a definite no in her book.
she stared out the window as Tad and Billy banged their heads and sang along. She didn't think Tad even noticed that she wasn't paying attention to him.
I might have to find someone else to give me a ride to school next year.
Miranda suddenly realized she was sick of Tad. Sick of the way he never really paid attention to her unless she was sitting in his lap. She did not want to spend every morning of freshman year being forced to listen to Iron Maiden. But who else in the junior or senior classes had a really good car and no girlfriend? Miranda would have to think on it. In the meantime, she just needed to get through the next couple of hours. Let Tad pay for her ticket and take her on a couple of rides. If she saw someone else more interesting, she could catch a ride home with that person. And if I don't see someone more interesting, I'm calling Dad to come and get me, she decided as they arrived at the fairgrounds parking area. It was just an open part of the field next to the fair itself, and there were no actual lines for the cars. Tad parked the Camaro diagonally, so it took up as much space as possible. Obnoxious jerk, Miranda thought. And then? No wonder Lauren ditched all of us the other day. No, she wasn't going to think about Lauren at all. That would put her in a really bad mood. She let Tad sling his arm around her shoulders, and they walked toward the bright lights of the fair. 19. Lauren smiled at Jake as they entered the fairgrounds together. He was wearing clean jeans and another one of what Lauren thought of as his interesting band shirts. This time, there was a woman with dark eyeliner and wild hair staring out from a white background. Underneath her face, it read, Susie and the Banshees. Lauren wanted to know what all of these bands sounded like. She wondered when Jake would make her the promised mixtape with the Clash and the Smiths and Susie and the Banshees and all the other cool things he liked. She wanted to know about the music he listened to and the books he read and how he felt about college. All she really knew about Jake Hansen was that he'd helped her play baseball when they were younger and that he had beautiful blue eyes. That was not, she decided, the proper basis for any kind of relationship. Even if this date turned out to be a mistake, they could still be friends. And friends knew things about each other and shared those things that they enjoyed. The way you and Miranda used to do. No, she was not going to think about Miranda now. She was going to enjoy her first date. Lauren had dressed carefully in her best jeans and her turquoise high tops and her favorite Prince t-shirt. It felt like good luck to wear it, because David had drawn the picture of her standing next to Jake, and her shirt had said, Purple Ran. What do you want to do first? Jake asked. Get something to eat? Lauren laughed and shook her head. Me and David ate half the fare today. I'm pretty sure I can go the rest of my life without ever having another thing fried in oil. But I'll get a Coke if you're hungry.
I am, he admitted. I didn't have a big lunch at work today.
What do you want? Pizza? A corn dog? A burger? I know where everything is, Lauren said. I could lead a tour of food booths.
Burger and fries, he said.
He didn't even take a minute to think about it. That's over by the zipper, Lauren said, pointing in the direction they needed to walk.
Over by the zipper. Officer Lopez needs your help. He's over by the zipper.
No. She wasn't going to think about that right now either. That strange moment when David had seemed to go into a trance, and what happened after. How they'd come upon a crowd of people who were acting, well, she didn't know how to think about it, except that they were acting wrong. As she and David approached the group, she'd felt something like an aura or a miasma, something that bound all of those present together. Something a lot like magic. And the thing she'd done, Lauren hadn't even considered what she would do or how she would do it. She'd simply known that if she spoke, the people caught in the grip of the spell, curse, would stop. David had quickly tugged her away when Officer Lopez was distracted, and she'd been relieved. She didn't want to answer any difficult questions. She sighed, because all of a sudden there seemed to be a lot of weird stuff going on. According to Nana, weird stuff had been a part of the fabric of Smith's Hollow since the beginning. But it seemed that all the weirdness was bubbling to the surface now, that there was an open seam of weird, and it was spreading like lava all around the town.
"You went away somewhere again," Jake said.
Lauren started. "Sorry."
"Where do you go when you're thinking those really deep thoughts?"
There was no way she could possibly explain about the dead girls, about the floating book, about seeing the blood on her bike seat and the vision in her head, about how she'd made a whole crowd of murderous adults go away just by telling them to do so. There was no way she could explain the strange feeling she got from David before she left the house for her date either.
"Be careful, Lauren."
That was all he'd said. "Be careful, Lauren." But it had seemed like he knew something she didn't when he said it. It felt like a lot of weight all of a sudden. The burden of strangeness, of knowledge that nobody else seemed to have. Well, except David and Nana. And David wasn't the ideal person to discuss it with. He was only 4. She'd like to tell Jake about it. Jake, with his very sympathetic eyes and his sincere interest. No, I can't tell him about all of this insanity. But maybe I can tell him about the legend. "I was just thinking about a story my Nana told me," Lauren said. "A kind of legend about Smith's Hollow."
"What, the legend of the man who saved the town by opening a meat processing plant?" Jake said.
They'd reached the hamburger booth by then, and Jake ordered 2 cheeseburgers, a large fry, and 2 Cokes. "Are you going to eat both of those burgers? They're really big," Lauren said. "Me and David split one earlier. Of course, we'd already had a funnel cake and cotton candy by then."
"I'm really hungry," he said. "Anyway, I usually eat 2 burgers."
Lauren inwardly marveled at the way teenage boys stayed so skinny, even though they ate everything under the sun. She wasn't as self-conscious about eating as Miranda was. Miranda wouldn't eat more than a lettuce leaf in front of another person, lest they accuse her of being fat. But she could never eat as much as Jake seemed prepared to do in one sitting. They got Jake's food and managed to find an unoccupied picnic table nearby. The sun was going down, and the fair lights were slowly coming on, the bright colors spinning as the rides whirled in every direction. Jake took a huge bite out of one of the burgers and then nudged the tray of fries in Lauren's direction.
"Feel free."
"Nah, I'm good," she said, sipping her Coke. She was surprised by how relaxed she felt, how natural. There was a little butterfly in her stomach. No, not even a butterfly, really. More like a moth. One of those tiny ones that occasionally flew out of her sweater drawer. And that smidge of nervousness was natural and normal. It was her first date, after all. But she didn't feel the way she thought she would. Awkward, full of worries about possibly saying or doing the wrong thing. Part of it was that Jake seemed so sincerely interested in her, in who she was inside. He wasn't only interested in groping her, whatever Miranda might think. And part of it was, well, whatever it was that had awakened inside her, this power, this witchiness.
"So, tell me about this legend," Jake said. "Before you go away somewhere again, I could see that look in your eye."
"What look?" Lauren asked.
"The one that says you're retreating inside your own mind? The one that says you don't think I'm the most fascinating guy you've ever met?"
He gave her a crooked smile at this, so she knew he was kidding. "Okay," Lauren said. "You know that tree in the woods? The one that looks like it was struck by lightning?"
"Yeah, I know the one you mean. It always gave me the creeps."
"Why?" she asked, genuinely curious. She'd never felt that way about the tree. She still didn't, even after Nana told her the story. And she found her bloodstained bike underneath its branches.
Something about it. It always seems like the tree is watching.
Well, maybe it is, Lauren said. And then she realized, it definitely is. There's something that lives inside the tree. Something that's trapped there. And the witches cursed us, so that whatever it is can come out once a year.
Why had this only occurred to her now, even after everything that had happened since she heard the story? It was as if her knowledge of the thing that lived in the tree kept shifting away, hiding behind other thoughts, so she wouldn't see it clearly.
Anyway, she said, before Jake accused her of going away someplace without him again. This is the story I heard. She took a deep breath and began. There was a hill just off the center of town, a lonely and inexplicable hill, a hill that should not be, for it blighted an otherwise perfectly flat and reasonable landscape. It felt like she was talking for a very long time. As she told the story, it was like she went away from the fair, went away from the noise and the colors and the cotton candy scented air. She was there with the three witches who lived on the hill, and was there when the red-haired one fell in love with a princeling. She was there when they married and loved and dreamed of the future. She was there in the woods when Elizabeth was torn to pieces by the man with the knife. Lauren didn't stop telling the story, but a part of her gasped in realization. That place where Elizabeth died, it was the exact same place where she and Jake had found what was left of the two dead girls. And that's where all the girls have died. Every single one. The sun was down by the time she finished. Jake hadn't spoken a word the entire time. And after a while, Lauren was only half aware of his presence. She thought that even if he'd gotten up and walked away, she would have finished the story. It was like a compulsion was laid on her to tell it all once she started. She picked up her Coke and took a sip. Most of the bubbles were gone, and all of the ice was melted, so instead of refreshing her, the syrup just stuck in the back of her throat. She glanced at Jake, wondering what he'd made of all this. He was crying. Jake? She said tentatively, reaching across the table to touch his hand.
I had an older sister, he said. His voice was dreamy and his eyes far away. 7 years older than me. Kind of like you and David. Her name was Jennifer. My parents like names that start with J. Jennifer and Jacob. Jenny and Jake. She had really beautiful long dark hair, you know. It went all the way down her back. She used to steal cookies from the kitchen and take them into her room and make a tent out of her comforter between her bed and the desk. Then she'd call me, and I'd come in her room, and we'd eat cookies in the fort and tell ghost stories. I didn't know a lot of ghost stories, though, because I was little. But she made up really good ones and knew how to tell them, too. I think she would have been a writer or maybe an actress. She was definitely pretty enough to be an actress. One day I woke up and my mom and dad were in a panic. Jenny wasn't in her bed, wasn't anywhere in the house, and nobody knew where she'd gone. Chief Christie came to the house and asked all of us, even me, a lot of questions about Jenny's friends and her moods and whether she'd ever talked about running away. But she would never run away. There was no reason why she would do that. She was only 15 years old. Where would she run away to, or how? She wasn't old enough to drive, and she didn't have a boyfriend. I remember my mom crying, just sitting at the kitchen table with tears running down her face.
but my dad didn't cry at all. His fists were clenched, and his face was made of stone, but he never cried. He never cried, even when Chief Christie came to the house 2 days later and said they'd found Jenny in the woods. I cried, though. I cried like I would never stop for 3 days after that. My mom started to get worried, thought maybe I'd need to go to a doctor. And then, all of a sudden, I did stop crying. Just click, like a switch that had been thrown. And it was weird, you know, what happened after that. We forgot her. Slowly, at first, there were times when I thought of her, even thought I could see her, standing in the kitchen with a stack of cookies in one hand and her finger over her mouth, or combing out her hair in front of the bathroom mirror. But after a while, her pictures were put away, and nobody told funny stories of things Jenny used to do. She was just gone. We never talked about her. It was as if she never existed, like I'd only dreamed I had an older sister.
As Jake spoke, a memory bubbled up inside Lauren. A memory of a girl with very long black hair and pretty blue eyes, building Play-Doh sculptures in Lauren's living room. "She was my babysitter," Lauren said. "I remember her." Jake's eyes came back from the place where he'd gone, and he gripped Lauren's hand hard.
"It's a true story, isn't it? The one that you told me? It's all true. The town is under a curse."
His grip was hurting her hand, but she didn't try to pull it away.
"I think so. Yes. It's true."
"How can that be?"
His tone was pleading, begging her to say it was all a scary story for a summer's night.
"How can there really be witches and curses and monsters that live in the woods? It's the 20th century, for God's sake."
"I don't know," she said slowly. "But I think it's coming undone. I think that if it weren't, you wouldn't have remembered your sister. And there have been other weird things."
"What kind of other weird things?"
Lauren hesitated, wondering if she should tell him. It seemed he would believe her if she talked about magic. But then again, how would he feel about her if he knew that she was related to the original three witches? Would he turn away from her in horror? Would he blame her for his sister's death? That wouldn't be logical, but then grief wasn't always a logical thing. And Jake's grief was all fresh and new again. She could see it on his face, like a bruise.
"Listen, this isn't really the best place to talk about this. I shouldn't have told that story," she said.
His grip softened, but he didn't let go of her hand. He scrubbed at his face with his other arm.
"You're right. This isn't a good place to talk about this."
"Do you want to go home?" she asked. "It's okay if you do." He seemed to come to a decision then.
"No, let's stick with the original plan. I wanted to take you out and have fun, and we should do that."
Lauren surveyed him doubtfully. "I don't want to feel like I'm forcing you." Jake smiled, a smile that made her heart go loop the loop.
"I've wanted to go out with you for so long. I'm not going to blow it now just because the town is cursed."
She laughed, and he squeezed her hand gently.
"Want to go on the merry-go-round with me?" he said.
"Definitely." They got up and headed in the direction of the merry-go-round. He didn't let go of her hand either. 20. Miranda saw Lauren and Jake Hansen sitting at the picnic table holding hands. They seemed to be having a very intense conversation, looking soulfully into each other's eyes.
He's probably telling her some bullshit about how he adores her, and later, he'll have his hands underneath her undershirt grabbing at her tiny breasts. Tad had already grabbed at Miranda's much more substantial breasts while they rode the Himalaya. She hadn't cared so much about that, but his breath had been sour when he put his face close to hers, and she turned her head away so he could suck at her neck instead. What she really wanted was to go home. She was tired of pretending that Tad was interesting. After they rode the Himalaya, Tad and Billy decided they wanted to try their hand at the shooting gallery booth. Miranda murmured that she needed to powder her nose and slipped off in the direction of the bathrooms. On the way, she saw Lauren standing alone. Jake must have gone to the bathroom himself, or went off to fetch her some food so she wouldn't have to stand in the increasingly long lines. Miranda thought about detouring over to make a snide remark about Lauren's date, but decided against it. They might end up screaming at each other in the middle of the fair, and Miranda didn't want to make a scene. The fair was pretty wall-to-wall then, and it was difficult to walk even a few feet without bumping into someone. She'd spotted Officers Lopez and Miller handing off to Officer Pantaleo, a man who appeared so drunk that it looked like he was made of rubber. Everywhere she looked, people were screaming, running, laughing, stuffing greasy food in their faces. Why had she wanted to come here at all? Tad hadn't even noticed her dress. A hard hand clamped under her elbow. She started to jerk away, then looked up and realized it was him. She relaxed as he steered her away from the crowd. I'm so glad it's you. I want to get out of here. Let's go somewhere quiet. He nodded, but there was a strange look on his face. She noticed that he was pushing her toward the deep pool of darkness between the haunted house and the tent where the acrobats were performing. Miranda heard the gasps and cries coming from the audience inside the tent. She thought she knew what this was about. He wanted a little something from her. Well, she didn't mind. He wasn't Tad, after all. 21. He had to get rid of the little slut. He realized that now. The only way that Lauren would know she was the only one for him was if Miranda went away. He had to show Lauren, show her that she was his one and only love, show her what he was willing to sacrifice for her. Besides, the thing inside him was hungry again. He could feel its mouth opening wide, feel the curve of its claws longing to sink into soft flesh. The slut smiled up at him and pressed her chest against him as he pushed her into the shadows. He put his hand over her mouth. There was just enough light for him to see the glint of her eyes, the welcome that shifted into fear. The crowd in the tent next door clapped and shouted. No one would hear her scream. 22. Miranda looked into the face of her lover, or what she thought was her lover. His mouth wasn't right. It was huge and black and seeping across his face in a way that no human mouth should. The hand across her mouth didn't feel like a hand anymore. The sharp tips of his fingers dug into her cheek and tore the skin. I want to go home. I want my mommy. 23. Lauren fiddled with the hem of her shirt. It seemed like Jake had been gone a very long time. Though looking at the lines for every booth, it was probably to be expected. She'd lost sight of him in the crowd. An easy thing to do when you're such a shorty, she thought. Lauren had seen a few people she knew. Mr. and Mrs. Arakawa climbing into a gondola on the Ferris wheel. Some girls from junior high, walking in a large pack and giggling. Tad and Miranda
choosing a seat on the Himalaya. Lauren had made sure not to make eye contact with Miranda. She didn't know what would happen if their eyes met. Probably nothing, or maybe Miranda would flip her the bird. Lauren didn't want to take any chances, though. This day had already been strange and upsetting. She and Jake were still getting their equilibrium back after the story and Jake's fresh memories. Mayor Toohey was walking around, greeting everyone he met like he was at a voters' rally. She'd waved at Officer Hendricks as she and Jake exited the merry-go-round. All of the town police officers seemed to be at the fair that night, and Lauren bet they had their hands full with so many people around. She hoped that Officer Lopez wouldn't try to corner her and ask questions about what happened earlier. "Hey," Jake said from behind her. "I thought you would come from that direction." She pointed at the lines of people that were now behind her.
"I thought it would be faster to go a little farther away and hopefully find a shorter line. There was a popcorn booth by the haunted house that wasn't too bad, but then I had to fight the crowds to get back to you," he said, handing her a cardboard container of popcorn. "Want to go in the haunted house?"
"No," Lauren said. "I don't like them."
"Scared?" Jake asked. But it wasn't the way Miranda would have said it, as a taunt. He seemed curious.
"Not exactly scared," Lauren said, "but I don't like people jumping out at me."
"How about the acrobats, then?" he said. "The tent is right next to the haunted house, and we could sit down for a while."
"Sure," Lauren said. She wouldn't mind sitting for a while. David had wanted to walk all over the whole fair earlier. She was pretty active, but it was mostly bike riding. She wasn't used to so much walking in one day. They strolled at a leisurely pace, eating popcorn and talking about nothing in particular, movies they liked, books they had read. Even though the date hadn't been perfectly ideal so far, Lauren still felt warm and content and happy. He liked her. He wanted to be with her, with no strings and no expectations. And he made her feel like she could be herself. It had been a very long time since she'd felt that way. "Before Dad died, before Miranda changed. You changed too, you know." Yes, she had changed, although she hadn't realized it when it was happening. They'd grown apart. They wanted different things. And it was okay for that to happen. She resolved then that she would call Miranda the next day. Even if they weren't best friends forever anymore, Lauren should at least say she was sorry. She shouldn't have called Miranda names. And it would be nice if they could at least be friendly to one another, not turn away as if the other were made of poison. The haunted house and the acrobat tent were on the outermost loop of the fairgrounds, with nothing behind them except the last bit of empty field. They followed the curve of the pathway around to the left, walking in front of the haunted house. A lot of loud screaming and laughter was coming from inside, but there was nobody else around on the path. Everyone in this part of the fair was inside the haunted house or the tent. Past the acrobat tent was a large barn, a temporary structure built to hold a petting zoo. The ripe scent of animals drifted toward them, and Jake wrinkled his nose.
"Don't you like animals?" Lauren asked.
"It's not that," he said, turning his face away and covering his nose and mouth with his hand as he sneezed.
"I'm allergic to animal hair."
"Ah, no cute little sheep and pigs for you," Lauren said.
"Pigs aren't cute."
"Baby pigs are really cute," she said.
"I respectfully disagree. The only way I like a pig is when it's been cured into bacon."
"Oh, no," Lauren said, laughing. "Don't say the cute little piggies get turned into bacon."
"Bacon and ham and Sunday pork roast," Jake said, making a snuffling noise like a pig.
She was going to say something else, something about Wilbur from Charlotte's Web, but then she noticed that her sneakers were sticking in something. They were just in front of the space between the haunted house and the acrobat tent. "Hey, what the—" she said, crossing her right ankle over her left knee so she could see the sole. there was something dark and sticky, like thick syrup all over the rubber bottom. A pool of the dark stuff was seeping out of the shadows between the tent and the haunted house. Jake crouched down to try to get a closer look, and Lauren joined him. She got a whiff of it then and stood up quickly, backing away.
"Hey, what's the matter?" he said.
"It's blood," she said. "Can't you smell it?"
"No, my nose is stuffed up from the animals," he said, standing up just as fast.
"Something wrong?" Lauren spun around and saw Officers Lopez and Miller approaching from the direction she and Jake had just come from.
"There's blood," Lauren said, pointing. "A great big pool of blood."
Officer Miller looked indulgent.
"Nah, it's probably not blood. I bet it's some trick to do with the haunted house."
"Let's have a look," Officer Lopez said, taking his flashlight off his belt. He clicked it on, and all four of them peered into the little alleyway between the tent and the haunted house. At first, Lauren wasn't really sure what she was looking at, because it was all in bits and pieces, and her brain did not want to make sense of it. She thought maybe someone had slaughtered an animal for a sick joke. Then she saw the yellow dress, or what was left of it, and the yellow hair, stained in red, and Miranda's head, not attached to the rest of her. Her eyes wide and her mouth open in a scream.
"Miranda," she said, and felt her legs turn to water underneath her.
Jake grabbed her before she fell down into the pool of Miranda's blood, and she clutched at his shirt, unable to support herself.
"Ah, oh, Jesus, Mary Joseph," Miller said.
He made a choking sound.
"Don't puke in the crime scene," Officer Lopez said.
"You two, back away, but don't go anywhere, all right? I'm going to need a statement from you." Lauren was amazed at how calm he sounded. He got on his radio and called Chief Christie, and his voice didn't waver for an instant. He lowered the flashlight, and Lauren was relieved not to see Miranda's eyes.
"Why you? I was going to call you tomorrow. I was going to tell you I was sorry. Miranda, I'm so sorry."
Miller ran in front of the haunted house and began to retch.
"It's the same as my sister," Jake said. "The same as those girls in Mrs. Schneider's yard."
Officer Lopez gave Jake a sharp look. "What do you know about that?"
"The same as all the girls,"
Lauren said. Blood was roaring in her ears. She spoke without really noticing what she said.
"Except not. This isn't how it's supposed to happen."
"How what's supposed to happen? Lauren, do you know something? Do you know who's doing this?" Officer Lopez came closer to them, his voice an undertone, like he didn't want Miller to hear.
"There's something wrong in this town," Lauren said. "Something very wrong."
"What's all the fuss over here?"
Mayor Toohey's voice, too hearty, completely unwelcome, came from the entrance of the acrobat tent. He had just exited and walked over to join them. Toohey glanced sharply from Miller's bent form to Lopez's somber face to Lauren and Jake, who were holding on to each other for dear life.
"Has something happened?"
"Hey, what's that?"
Jake asked, pointing at a shadow on the side of the tent just above Miranda. Officer Lopez raised his flashlight. It swept past Miranda's head, and Toohey sucked in a breath.
"Not another one," he said,
so low that Lauren barely heard him.
"It's not time."
The beam of the flashlight touched the tent wall where Jake pointed. Something was written there. Something in large, streaky red letters. "Only you, Lauren." Lauren felt her blood rush to her head and her chest turn ice cold. The last thing she heard was Jake saying,
"Lauren? Lauren?"
and then there was nothing else. 24. Karen wasn't surprised that David wanted to go to bed early that night. It sounded like he and Lauren had done every single thing at the fair.
"Except the haunted house,"
he'd said in his most serious voice.
"Because Lauren doesn't like them."
He was a good sleeper anyway. Had been since he was a baby. David had never been one of those children who fussed and fought at bedtime. He didn't mind taking a bath either. The exact opposite of Lauren as a toddler, who would scream if her hair got wet and have to be wrestled down to rinse out the shampoo. He'd nodded off at the dinner table, just in the middle of telling her about Lauren winning the stuffed frog from the water gun game. His voice drifted away, and his eyes closed, and his head lolled forward. She'd gently shaken him awake. "Do you want to go to bed now?"
"Okay,"
he said. She'd picked him up, thinking, "He's so big now, I can hardly carry him at all." He snuggled his head onto her shoulder. "Do you think you can take a bath?" she asked. She hated to put him into bed all covered in dust and funnel cake sugar from the fair.
"Okay,"
he said sleepily. He stood, swaying gently while she ran a warm bath. She quickly washed him and got him into his pajamas and led him to his bedroom. He climbed in and pulled his top sheet up to his chin. The sheets were white, with scenes from the Peanuts cartoon all over them. "Good night, David," she said, kissing his forehead.
"Good night, Mommy,"
he murmured. His eyes were already closed. It was still light out, so she went to the window and closed the blinds and pulled the curtain shut. She tiptoed toward the door, though she thought he probably was out cold already. He turned onto his side just as she reached the door and said,
"Goodbye, Miranda."
Karen glanced back at him. He sounded so sad. He must be having a dream, she thought, and went downstairs. She cleaned up the dinner things, glancing at the clock. She hoped that Lauren was having a good time at the fair with Jake Hansen. That had been a surprise. And the age difference had given Karen pause, but in the end, she decided to let Lauren go. Her daughter had been a little melancholy since their argument with Miranda. It was too hot to make tea or coffee, so Karen took a can of tab out to the back porch and opened it there. She wouldn't mind a glass of wine, she realized, but she didn't have any in the house. It had become a very rare indulgence since Joe died. Lauren, standing at the back door, tugging on the knob. There was that memory again. Karen sat in one of the lawn chairs and put her feet up on the porch railing, thinking. One of her neighbors was grilling. She smelled the smoke and the scent of cooking meat lingering in the heavy summer air. It was such a hot summer already. It made her feel languid and drifting. She closed her eyes against the glow of the setting sun. Lauren standing at the back door, tugging on the doorknob. "Lauren!" Joe was standing next to her, shaking their daughter's shoulder, but she didn't respond to his voice or his touch. "Lauren!" Her eyes were wide open, like she was sleepwalking, but she'd never sleepwalked before. Karen watched her daughter try to open the locked door, and her husband tried to stop Lauren from leaving. Karen had a sudden flash then, a kind of terrible knowledge that made her stagger and clutch the counter for support so she could stay upright. Joe ceased trying to stop Lauren and stared at his wife, and she saw the same terrible knowledge in his eyes. "We're supposed to let her go," Karen said. "Open the door for her and lock it behind her. And tomorrow she'll be dead, found in the woods. But it's all for the greater good," Joe intoned, like he was reciting something he'd memorized. "And in time, we'll forget." Forget, Karen thought, and shuddered. Forget her smart and beautiful and oh-so-difficult daughter.
forget Lauren had ever existed. Just like Nancy. But that memory was only a flash, a nearly subliminal image that flew past as she stared at Lauren and Joe standing by the door. Her husband's mouth was twisted in disgust.
Does everybody do this? They open the door for their daughters to be murdered?
They must, Karen said.
They must, because it happens every year. But then we all forget about it, so that it can happen again.
It's not happening this time, Joe said. I'm not sending my child out into the night to die.
But what happens if we don't? Karen whispered. Will we all die?
No, Joe said. I'm going to stop it, whatever it is.
She thought she couldn't possibly be more afraid than she was. But the idea of Joe going out to confront, well, she wasn't certain what he would confront, but she remembered at that very moment that all the girls had died in the woods, their heads torn from their bodies.
It will kill you,
she said, going to him then and grasping his arm.
It will tear you to pieces.
No, it won't, he said. I'm not some teenage girl blindly walking into its nest. The only way to stop this is if we resist.
You don't know that.
She was panicking. Felt it rising in her throat and choking her.
I won't send Lauren out, but I'm not letting you go either. Listen, you take Lauren upstairs and lock her in her bedroom. Don't let her out until morning, no matter what she says or does.
Joe, no, I won't let you.
You can't stop me, he said.
And he gave her that crooked smile, the one that had made her heart flutter on the day they first met. They hadn't always been happy. Their marriage hadn't been perfect. But she loved him deep down in her bones. And she didn't want him to die.
Promise me that you'll keep Lauren safe, he said. Promise.
Yes, I promise, she said.
She couldn't stop him. Nothing she said or did had ever been able to move him once he decided on a thing. He and Lauren were the same that way. He pushed at Lauren's shoulders, tried to steer her back to Karen. It's like trying to move a mechanical soldier that only wants to march in one direction, Karen thought. Lauren's feet kept moving toward the door. Her upper body angled toward it like it was tugging on her. Her face was blank, and her eyes were lifeless. Karen got in front of Lauren and tried to turn her around, but it was impossible. It wasn't that Lauren was stronger than Karen, only that she could not be moved. The compulsion was forcing her in one direction only, toward her death. It was terrible to realize that her daughter would march willingly to the slaughter, and worse, that she and Joe were expected to be complicit in Lauren's death. And this happened all over town, every year. Every year, some girl's family let her out of the house in the middle of the night, knowing what would happen to her. And the next morning, they would wake up with no memory of their actions. Their daughter seemingly spirited away by fairies in the night. Karen pushed at Lauren's shoulders and was able to shift her a few feet away from the door. As soon as there was clearance, she heard Joe unlock the door behind her.
Wait,
she cried. They hadn't really had a chance to say goodbye. Karen kept a firm grip on Lauren's shoulders and glanced back at the door.
I'll come back, he said.
All she saw of him was his face framed in the closing door for a moment before he pulled it shut. She heard him locking it from the outside and noticed that he'd had the foresight to grab his keys from the hook by the door, which was a very good thing because her grip had slackened when she saw him leave. And as soon as it did, Lauren pushed forward again. Karen dug her heels in, tried to stop her.
but all she succeeded in doing was arresting the forward motion. Lauren still marched in place, her eyes locked on the door. Karen thought, almost hysterically, of a Dr. Seuss story that David thought was funny. One about creatures called Zacks, who only walked in one direction and would never step to one side for an obstacle. They stood there all night. Lauren pushing toward the door. Karen pushing back and growing increasingly exhausted. Then suddenly, Lauren stopped, her legs buckling beneath her like her batteries had abruptly died.
Lauren,
Karen cried, catching her as she fell. Lauren's head lolled backward, her eyes closed, her breath deep and even. She was asleep. Karen carefully lowered her to the ground, where Lauren turned onto her left side and tucked her hands underneath her face, like she always had since she was very small. Her mother sat beside her, stroking her hair, and let the tears she'd been suppressing fall. She knew that Joe was never coming home. Karen opened her eyes and was startled to discover that it was night. She'd fallen asleep on the porch. Her neck hurt from resting against the hard metal and nylon of the lawn chair. Strange dream, she thought. Then, no, it wasn't a dream. It was a memory. The truth of this, and of everything else she now realized, made her hunch forward in pain, clutching her middle. Joe had not been cheating on her. He hadn't gone out that night to meet his mistress. He'd run out into the night to save their daughter, and he'd been killed by the monster instead. Joe hadn't stopped paying the money on his life insurance. The insurance money had disappeared when they'd broken the rules, when they hadn't let Lauren die as they were supposed to. But the charm or spell or curse had made Karen think things that weren't true, had made her forget that Lauren had nearly died. What is wrong with this town? She gasped. Why did this happen here? And why did she remember all of a sudden? Why were things rushing back to her now, her childhood best friend, and the truth about Joe? Why did she feel as if she could name every girl that had gone missing in the last 20 years? What was different now? The phone inside rang, startling her. She got up and rubbed her head, which was aching now. Just as she opened the screen door, David began to wail, crying like she'd never heard him cry before. Karen ran past the insistently trilling phone without stopping. 25. Mrs. Schneider looked around at the circle of expectant faces in her living room. Many people had come when she called, more than she'd thought. There were 20 of them squashed together on her sofa or perched on the armrests of the chairs. Mr. Schneider would not have liked that. No, he would not. He would have thought it rude. And some of the younger ones sitting cross-legged on the floor, like they were in kindergarten again. No one was talking. A sense of hushed resolve hung around the room. A feeling that they all knew their purpose and were willing to fulfill it. For the first time in a very long time, her mind felt clear. No fog obscured her memories of Janie or of the other girls. If she tried, she thought she could name off everyone that had died in her lifetime. Not died. Murdered. No, not murdered either. Sacrificed. A few of them were her own neighbors, and she saw the knowledge that they too had suppressed for so long on their faces. No. Suppressed isn't the right word. Hidden. It was hidden from us. Hidden behind other things in our heads. And now, all the hidden things had come into the light,
and Mrs. Schneider knew why. It was because of the outsiders. If the outsiders went away, then everything would go back to the way it was before. That means girls will die again, one every year. Well, it was better if it was one girl a year, better than whatever was happening now. And before, it had always been safely in the woods, not in her backyard. All she wanted was for everything to go back to the way it was. She didn't want to think about Janie. Didn't want to hurt inside when she remembered her bright and beautiful daughter. "Thank you all for coming," she began. She stopped, clearing her throat. Everyone had turned to look at her expectantly. There was an odd look in their eyes, a look that was almost like they were waiting to be told what to do. "I don't have to convince them," she realized. "They already know." "I think it's time we purged our town of these outsiders," she said. "Once they're gone, everything will go back to the way it was before." Heads were nodding all around, no voice of dissent. "I don't think we should, hurt them, though," Mrs. Schneider said carefully. She did remember how that woman had been kind to her when they found the girls in her yard, and the outsiders had children. Filthy Mexican children that would have more filthy Mexican children, but children nonetheless. And Mrs. Schneider did not want to be responsible for the death of children. "I think perhaps we should just frighten them into leaving town forever." Again, everyone in the room nodded. It was so strange. She felt a flutter of nervousness, a momentary hesitation. It was very much like they were under some kind of spell. But she, Mrs. Schneider, was not a witch. There was something in the air, something that had drawn all of them to her house and made them listen and obey. "The sooner we take care of this problem, the sooner our lives can return to normal. We will be able to forget again." Yes, forget. 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 The word went all around the room from person to person like falling dominoes. "Yes, forget this pain. Forget that Mr. Schneider and I opened the door and let Janie out that night and locked it up tight behind her so the monster would get her instead of us. I have some things outside that will help us," she said. They all rose in an obedient line and followed her through the house and out the back door.